headlines. Delegations from Russia and Ukraine get together in Belarus for a third round of talks to see if they can find a solution to end the ongoing military conflict. Iran says the outlook for the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA remains unclear due to U.S. delay in making political decisions. In Sana'a, Yemenis turn out in force against U.S.-supported Saudi-enforced oil blockade, saying that they will never cave in to pressure. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Russian jets have bombed a Vinnytsia airport in central Ukraine, leaving at least 9 people dead. This as pro-Russia forces have arrived in Mariupol, in the strategic city that has been besieged for days. The Russian military has also downed some Ukrainian aircraft and drones. On the other side, Ukrainian forces have regained control of Mykolaiv Airport in the south and the town of Chernihiv in the north. In the meantime, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is calling on his Western allies for more anti-Russia sanctions.
If the invasion continues and Russia has not abandoned its plans against Ukraine, then we need a new sanctions package, new sanctions moves against war for peace. What is needed is a boycott of Russian exports, in particular the rejection of oil and oil products from Russia.
Zelensky called on Western countries for fighter jets and more air defense assets. He also renewed his demands for a no-fly zone over Ukraine. The Kremlin says it is ready to halt its operation the moment Kiev meets its conditions. Moscow is demanding Kiev stop its military action and change its constitution so that it would not be able to enter any bloc. Plus, it wants Ukraine to acknowledge Crimea as Russian territory and recognize the independence of Luhansk and Donetsk regions. The UN Human Rights Office says that more than 400 civilians have been killed since the start of the conflict. The UN also says that 1.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country. Russia announces the opening of humanitarian corridors to allow Ukrainian civilians evacuate the areas of conflict.
Today, March the 7th, since 10 a.m. Moscow time, Russia declares a silence regime and opens 6 humanitarian corridors. Detailed information about the humanitarian corridors was given to the Ukrainian side in advance, as well as dedicated entities of the UN, OSCE and international committees of the Red Cross. For the period of humanitarian corridors opening, Russian armed forces of Russian Federation will be continually and objectively monitoring the evacuation process by using unmanned aerial vehicles.
The Russian Defense Ministry spokesman says one of the corridors will be from the capital Kiev to Homel, a city in southeastern Belarus. However, Kiev claims that these corridors have not been opened yet, slamming the Russian announcement as an immoral stunt. The Ukrainian deputy prime minister says the only corridors are those to allow crossing into Russia or Belarus.
Today, March the 7th, since 10 a.m. Moscow time, Russia declares a silence regime and opens 6 humanitarian corridors.
It is an unacceptable scenario of opening humanitarian corridors. Our people from Ivankiv, Dermir, Vyshhorod and Kiev will not go to Belarus to go afterwards to the Russian Federation by plane.
The Ukrainian deputy prime minister urged Russia to open routes specified by Kiev. She also called on Ukraine's allies to help open, in her words, real and effective humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians. Vereshchuk also urged Moscow to establish a ceasefire acceptable to Kiev. This as a Russian and Ukrainian delegations are holding their third round of peace talks in the Belarusian city of Brest. The previous two rounds made no clear breakthroughs. In the meantime, Turkey says that it is also trying to mediate a meeting between the top Russian and Ukrainian diplomats. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu says the meeting will take place in the southern city of Antalya on Thursday.
It is an unacceptable scenario of opening humanitarian.
And outcry is growing over the European Union's comparatively red carpet treatment of Ukrainian refugees after years of appalling treatment towards non-white asylum seekers. Many in France are demanding that European nations take responsibility for all refugees, especially for the refugee crises which have been fomented by Western violence. Ramin Mazahari has more.
In a historic and surprising decision, the European Union has decided to give refugees from war the instant right to live within the bloc and freely travel. They also have the right to work. They even now have rights to housing and medical care. There is one catch. This only applies to Ukrainians. These rights are not being extended to refugees from Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, Mali, the Central African Republic, or any of the other countries in which Western armed interventions provoked refugee crises. Seemingly no one would begrudge Ukrainian refugees their human rights, but many in France are wondering why they are getting treated totally differently from black, brown, and Muslim asylum seekers.
Apparently, you have to be white and Christian to be treated properly by the European Union. That's the sad reality, and it's totally unacceptable. We cannot discriminate according to religion, nationality, or color, which are all things which we don't choose. What we can choose is to be human and to have solidarity with each other.
Drowning by the dozens in Calais, France. Freezing to death in Poland. Packed into camps in Italy. Building steel fences, denying basic sanitation, fear-mongering about refugees election after election. The long-running European refugee crisis has taken a new turn, and yet standard European policy remains mostly unchanged. An outcry is growing for the European Union to extend their unity, and many say their humanity, towards non-white refugees. Many say the open discrimination, which reveals a deep racism and xenophobia, as well as an arrogant hypocrisy, will ultimately stain the European Union around the world and at home. Many in the French media are describing Ukrainian refugees as somehow qualitatively superior to other asylum seekers. However, many hope that the European Union realizes soon that all refugees are equal and deserving of dignity, assistance, and the same rights without discrimination. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says the watchdog will try to narrow the gaps with Iran as diplomatic efforts to revive the 2015 deal continue in Vienna.
We hope to move, if there is an agreement, to move into solid ground. But there is the gap, and this is what we have to do. As sometimes you hear at the London Tube, mind the gap. So there is a gap. And we have to look at what has been happening. We have to reconcile. We have to reconcile the information. We have to make sure that whatever has been happening and we were not being able to verify in the right way is perfectly accounted for to the gram.
Morosi was speaking after a meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors. He added that the agency will continue to verify Iran's compliance with the safeguards issues. Last week, Iran and the IAEA issued a joint statement following Grossi's visit to Tehran. They stressed the importance of accelerating and strengthening cooperation and dialogue to resolve some of the remaining issues between the two sides. The U.S. delay in making political decisions has thrown the prospect of the deal to restore the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA into uncertainty. That, according to the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said, "The priority of Iranian negotiators is to resolve the outstanding issues that are considered Tehran's red lines." The top Iranian security official said the quick arrival at a strong deal requires new initiatives from all parties. Iran and the other remaining parties to the JCPOA have been engaged in negotiations in Vienna since last April to restore the deal that was left in tatters after the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Iran says only a handful of differences remain to be settled, and an agreement is within reach if the other sides do not raise new issues. Tehran says it is not bound by any deadlines and only seeks what it describes as a good deal. Earlier, journalist and political analyst Abbas Aslani joined us with the latest on the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal.
The negotiations here in Vienna continue in order to reach a good deal. But from Iranian perspective, a good agreement will include lifting of the sanctions. I have been hearing, according to the sources, that discussions were made on some remaining issues, and they are waiting for the American delegation to come with a decision on those issues. It seems that even the American delegation now in Vienna is waiting to hear from Washington, so it's not certain that when we can have an agreement, but it seems that the decision needs to come from the American side at least. You know, there have been issues that if there is an agreement, you know, Iran and Russia will need to have some cooperation on the peaceful aspects of the nuclear activities in Iran. So they want to make sure that that is not impacted by the sanctions that are imposed by West against Russia as a result of the crisis in Ukraine.
And in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, tens of thousands of people hit the streets to condemn the U.S.-supported Saudi-enforced oil blockade on their country. A number of Yemeni officials also addressed the crowd and warned of retaliation for losses and hardship inflicted by the Saudi-led coalition. The speaker said Yemenis will never cave into pressure or accept humiliation of any sort. They also slammed confiscation of their national resources. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies and backed by the U.S., launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed ever since. Incessant bombing campaigns have devastated the infrastructure of the impoverished nation. Half of the population is now facing hunger due to an air and land and sea blockade. The U.N. calls the Yemen crisis, the world's largest humanitarian crisis. And Iran's Al Alam Arabic News Network says Facebook has shut down its page in, quote, a clear violation of freedom of the press. Al Alam says its Facebook page, which had some 6 million followers, was shut down without prior notice on Sunday. It says the American company had earlier imposed strict limitations on how the news network could publish its stories. Facebook had suspended Al Alam's account temporarily over the past years for publishing pictures of Lebanese, Palestinian, and Yemeni resistance movements and covering the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Over the past years, Facebook has also occasionally suspended Press TV news, including after it covered post-election violence in the U.S. in January 2021. Senior U.S. officials went to Venezuela on Saturday to meet with the government of President Nicolas Maduro. This is while the U.S. calls his government illegitimate and has imposed several rounds of sanctions against the country. The meeting also coincides with an ongoing war between one of Caracas's allies, Russia, and Ukraine. This raises a question. Is the U.S. trying to weaken ties between Caracas and Moscow?
A U.S. delegation of senior State Department and White House officials traveled to the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, to meet with President Nicolas Maduro's government. The meeting is the highest-level visit by U.S. officials to Venezuela in years. It also coincides with an ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The question is, why should such a meeting take place at this time? Venezuela and the U.S. severed all diplomatic relations in 2019 following Washington's recognition of pro-U.S. opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president over the legitimate president Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. then imposed sanctions on individuals with ties to Maduro's government and on companies involved in exporting Venezuelan oil to provoke regime change in the Latin American country. Venezuela soon felt the impact of sanctions as its oil production reduced significantly. In response, Caracas turned to Russia, as well as Iran and China, for diplomatic and economic aid. Russian energy companies and banks have since played a major role in Venezuela's exporting of oil. Fast forward to today, Russia is involved in a conflict with Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will only halt his country's military operation if Ukraine is stopped fighting and if Moscow's demands are met. On the other hand, Western governments have targeted Russia with a barrage of sanctions. The U.S. has imposed a ban on the exports of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, European Union has excluded seven Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned two major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. And Germany has decided to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project. In a bid to punish Russia for attacking Ukraine, the US and its allies targeted Moscow's oil and gas sector via sanctions, and countries like Venezuela are potential substitutes. In addition, while the war in Ukraine continues unabated, Washington is paying closer attention to Moscow's allies in Latin America. Current and former U.S. officials believe that's because Washington thinks they could become security threats if the standoff with Russia deepens.
The U.S. is going to try to divide Russia from Latin America and the Caribbean. And interestingly enough, according to the White House itself, a lot of the sanctions imposed on Russia over this whole Ukraine nonsense are designed to target Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, because those countries are also sanctioned by the U.S. And those countries are also dependent on Russia for aid. Russian support and aid is one of the main reasons why these countries have been able to overcome the sanctions to begin with. So in a sense, the U.S. is targeting these countries indirectly by hitting Russia, and I think people are not going to fall for it.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, the Supreme Court on Thursday, 3rd of March, shut down efforts by a detainee at Guantanamo Bay to obtain information from two former CIA contractors involved in torturing him, ruling that the inquiry would impermissibly expose state secrets. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Adam Liptak. The piece is titled, CIA Black Sites Are State Secrets, The Supreme Court Rules. In the U.S., the Supreme Court on Thursday, 3rd of March, shut down efforts by a detainee at Guantanamo Bay to obtain information from two former CIA contractors involved in torturing him, ruling that the inquiry would impermissibly expose state secrets. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, writing for a badly fractured court, said, "The main question was whether the information sought by the detainee, known as Abu Zubaydah, would confirm the location of a CIA black site, which is widely known to have been in Poland." The Supreme Court justices split 6-3 on the question of whether the case could proceed. In dissent, Justice Neil Gorsuch, joined by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, said the government sought to avoid further embarrassment for past misdeeds. "The facts are hard to face," he wrote. "We know already that our government treated Abu Zubaydah brutally. More than 80 waterboarding sessions, hundreds of hours of live burial, and what it calls rectal rehydration. Further evidence along the same lines may lie in government's vaults. But as embarrassing as these facts may be, there is no state secret here. This court's duty is to the rule of law and the search for truth," Justice Gorsuch wrote. He added, "We should not let shame obscure our vision." Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, on the other hand, insisted that the question at issue was a limited one. "Obviously, the court condones neither terrorism nor torture," he wrote. "But in this case, we are required to decide only a narrow evidentiary dispute." He conceded that the location of the black site had been acknowledged by an international tribunal and a former president of Poland. But he wrote that official confirmation of the location of the torture by the United States government was a different matter. "It stands to reason that a former CIA insider's confirmation of confidential cooperation between the CIA and a foreign intelligence service could damage the CIA's clandestine relationships with foreign authorities," he wrote. "Confirmation by such an insider is different in kind from speculation in the press or even by foreign courts of law, because it leaves virtually no doubt as to the veracity of the information that has been confirmed. Abu Zubaydah sought to subpoena the contractors, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, in connection with a Polish criminal investigation. The inquiry was prompted by a determination by the European Court of Human Rights that he had been tortured in 2002 and 2003 at secret sites operated by the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, including one site in Poland. When the case United States v. Hussein, No. 20827, was argued in October, David F. Klein, a lawyer for Abu Zubaydah, said he was not seeking testimony about the location of the black site. "I'm not planning to ask, did it happen in Poland," he said. Rather, David Klein said, he sought information about his client's treatment. "What happened inside Abu Zubaydah's cell between December of 2002 and September of 2003, he asked, giving the dates during which his client was understood to be held in Poland. "How was Abu Zubaydah fed? What was his medical condition? What was his cell like? And yes, was he tortured?" Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer wrote, "Questions like those would inevitably tend to confirm or deny whether the CIA operated a detention site located in Poland." In a concurring opinion endorsing Justice Breyer's bottom line, but not his reasoning, Justice Clarence Thomas, joined by Justice Samuel Alito, wrote that The executive branch was entitled to even more deference than the majority had given it. Justice Elena Kagan, in a partial dissent in the case, said she agreed that the location of the black site must be protected, but said the case could nonetheless proceed. I would allow Abu Zubaydah to amend his request to remove all Poland-specific references, she wrote, so that he can obtain testimony about his detention in whatever country it took place. In his dissent, Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, who had defended the Bush administration's detention policies as a Justice Department official back in 2005 and 2006, said there was no point in barring testimony about the location of the site. We should not be ignorant as judges of what we know to be true as citizens, he wrote. The location of the CIA's detention site has been acknowledged by the former Polish president, investigated by the Council of Europe and proven beyond reasonable doubt to the European Court of Human Rights, he wrote. Doubtless, these disclosures may have done damage to national security interests, but nothing in the record of this case suggests that requiring the government to acknowledge what the world already knows to be true would invite a reasonable danger of additional harm to national security. Abu Zubaydah, whose real name is Zainul Abidin Muhammad Hussein, was captured in Pakistan in March of 2002 and was initially thought to be a high-level member of Al-Qaeda. A 2014 report from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence said the CIA later concluded that Abu Zubaydah was not a member of Al-Qaeda. He was the first prisoner held by the CIA after the 11th of September 2001 attacks to undergo so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, a euphemism for torture, which were based on a list of suggestions drawn up for use on him by Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Jessen, both psychologists. Dr. Mitchell has testified that he and Dr. Jessen, who had experience with an Air Force program that taught pilots how to resist torture, were hired by the CIA to consult on the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah. They were ultimately assigned to carry out the torture techniques on him in the summer of 2002. A federal judge granted the government's motion to block the subpoena, saying that proceeding with discovery would present an unacceptable risk for disclosing state secrets. But a divided three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, California, ruled that it might be possible to segregate information protected by the state secrets privilege, which bans disclosures that could endanger national security from other materials. The full Ninth Circuit declined to rehear the panel's decision over the dissents of 12 judges who said the ruling was riddled with grave legal errors and posed a serious risk to our national security.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Viewpoints. Joining us in the studio today is their friend Sheikh Muhammad Khani from the Islamic Seminary of Qom and Dr. Ali Alawiyan. I welcome you both to this program and I hope that we will have a fruitful discussion today. Bi-idhnillahi ta'ala.
Thank you very much.
Our topic today, dear friends, is about drugs, more specifically drug addiction. Yeah. Dear Sheikh, do we have any treatments mentioned in Islam, how we can treat such a problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, I know there's a association right now that are dealing with these issues and finding solutions that they can actually implement in the different rehab centers around Iran. But if we have to look at what is drug addiction is basically a habit. It's an addiction, right? So right. It's something that you're used to because of the pleasure that are behind it. So normally when they discuss this in ethics, when it comes to habits, how to deal with habits, especially if it's a bad habit, normally they say that you have to replace that habit, especially if it's accompanied by some sort of a pleasure.
Right.
Because a person is normally not ready to sacrifice the pleasure if not it's replaced with something, right?
True, yeah.
So if a person understands or he felt or experienced the pleasure of being a healthy person, normally he's not willing to sacrifice this pleasure for a pleasure that is lower than that. For example, eating unhealthy, there's some pleasure related to that as well. Yeah. But if you're a healthy person and you experience what it means to be healthy, you're normally not willing to eat unhealthy and experience that pleasure because you're going to sacrifice another and greater pleasure because of that.
So we should introduce something that is, I don't want to say as addictive, but as pleasurable as drugs.
We should find a solution and give him the tools to actually strengthen his own willpower. That's first and foremost, yeah? Because they have to come from outside. You cannot control people's addictions. Right. You cannot be like, you shouldn't do it if he wants to do it. Sooner or later, if he's under control, if he's in a controlled environment, sooner or later he's going to do it. You can control it for a period, for example. That's why we say, like, when we have to raise our children, we do exactly the same thing. We give them the willpower enough or strengthen their willpower enough so they can take the right decisions when they grow older.
So we should focus on a cure is what we are in agreement then. Mm. One such cure or a manner of controlling these drug addicts, especially in the US, and it has now spread in the world, is to legalize some drugs, some less harmful drugs such as marijuana. Do you, dear Sheikh, think that this is an effective method?
That's a very good discussion because I actually looked into it and apparently there's a huge discussion when it comes to fiqh about whether marijuana is legal or not, whether it's been considered as being muskir or not, and goes under that definition. There's a huge discussion. Normally, our scholars, respected scholars today, they consider it to be impermissible because of the side effects of it, the harm it causes on a society, for a human being, and so on and so forth.
Harm? Which harm, if I might ask?
Yeah, like, for example, if a person is addicted to it, there's a lot of other aspects of his life which he normally doesn't take care of. Like, for example, his family. Right. Normally, there's abuse related to, like, for example, smoking a lot or excessive use of these things, of these drugs. The harm in the society is, for example, criminality is often related to selling drugs.
That's why we legalize it.
Yeah, but that's the question. If you legalize it, what you're actually doing, you're pushing the borders further, right?
Right.
So now they can't make money on marijuana and drugs like marijuana, light drugs, as we define them as. But there's always like heroin, cocaine, and so they can always change it with something else, right? We're just pushing the borders for what's being normalized in the inner society. So I don't think it's the right way to actually go, because the criminality or the criminal activity, they're not just gonna stop and be like, okay, now we don't have any way to make money. They're gonna find something else. Right?
In this way, I think we need to go again to legislate what cigarette is. But the legislation of cigarette, we have to review. And we have seen even in recent scholars and religious authorities like Ayatollah Makarem, Hafizahullah, he also actually no cigarette as something haram for a person to use it.
But when do that, dear doctor, you subconsciously you have to set some rules, because if we say cigarettes are harmful, what about using cola, drinking cola, which is very harmful?
As I said earlier, we have a general rule. that لا تلقبيدكم لا تاكل. You are not allowed to harm yourself.
Yeah.
You see, even cola, in case you are sure that it is harming you, so you are not allowed to use it. So when you are sure that it's harming you, so you
but
need to.
But where is the border, doctor? Because some foods are also harmful but delicious, but we eat them. Full of fat and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Where is the border, dear Sheikh? Do we have a border, or is it just up to the mukallaf, to the Muslim himself?
Yeah, that's where we go to the experts within the respected fields, and we talk with the experts about what is harming and what's not, right? Because maybe soda, for example, or cola can be harmful for me, but it's not for you. Why? Because you're healthy. You're a person that goes to the gym, you work out regularly, and so on and so forth. So it's really hard to give a general ruling or as a state come and make some regulations on these things if it's not something which harms the society in a broader manner, like we see directly with drugs, for example, marijuana, hashish, and these things.
Right.
We can see there's a direct relation between consuming these things and, for example, violence or, for example, people making money of it. Criminal activities, abuse in homes and stuff like that. So there's a relation that makes it much more harmful than other things.
Right.
So I think that's what we leave to the experts, for them to define what's harmful and what's not. And as the respected doctor, he mentioned as well, we have general rulings on these things, and we have to define what's harmful and what's not by asking the expert or talking to the expert.
The same case might go for the music and the different types of qana.
Yeah.
So then it's a part of it has been left on the duty-bound person, the person who is going to act upon that. So the marja or the religious authority tells you these are the criteria for something which is going to be halal, and these criteria are for the ones which are forbidden to be listened to. So then you, as a mukallaf, based on your understanding, act upon it. And when you yourself adhere yourself to act upon whatever you have learned properly, then you will be ma'jur. You will be given the reward. Will be given the reward for your good understanding of it. Whether at the end of the day you understood, for example, that what you understood at that time earlier, it was wrong. So for the time that you have understood and you had tried your best to know what is halal and what is haram, then you are rewarded, inshallah.
Then, doctor, let me ask you this question. We have a person who is stressed about work, about studies, very stressful lifestyle. Maybe he's a student. He has no time. He has not a lot of free time for his activities. He uses marijuana, for example, to smoke and relax his mind. Just like some people drink coal and watch a movie. Instead of doing that, he smokes marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Is he allowed to do that? Should we say, no, you cannot do that, it is harmful to you, when he is just going to say, no, it is beneficent for me?
Again, I think the answer is quite clear based on the Islamic rulings. Islam wants us to be wise in every aspect and moment of our life. Islam does not want us to be out of rationality and intellectualism, right?
Right.
So whatever makes this wisdom go away, so should be prevented from using.
But, dear brother, every type of entertainment that distracts you from your programs...
Sometimes you entertain yourself, and even we can give a sort of, let's say, a color of... a divine color to our entertainment. We do entertainment for having a healthier body, right?
And he smokes so he can study better.
But you say that he wants to relieve himself from all the problems that he have to leave just what the rationality and wisdom is.
But
right?
Here comes the question, do every goal justify its means, right?
So the ends justify the means, exactly.
Yeah, so I would say no, of course not, right? Because there's different ways of meeting your needs. For example, a person who needs some calmness in his life, is marijuana the right solution for that person? I would say no. Why? It's a temporary solution. It's a solution that's going to cause him more harm than actually solving the issue from the core, right? You're not going to find that tranquility or that calmness within yourself by smoking marijuana or intoxicating yourself. That's not the solution for having calmness in your heart, right?
Right.
So we have to look at what is it that you actually are trying to achieve, and do you achieve that by, for example, taking drugs? I would say no, of course you don't. Because then you're controlled by something which is external, something which is outside of yourself. And the idea within the Islamic paradigm is that you are actually, you're getting that tranquility and calmness in your faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right? Sheikh. In your lifestyle, the way you live, it comes from yourself. It's not external factors that actually gives you that calmness in your heart, right?
But if we apply that very same logic to a lot of other fun activities, we reach the same result. Like, you shouldn't watch so many movies. You shouldn't have a movie night. You shouldn't go to the cinema.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Should we also say stop doing that?
No, I would say excessive use of these things, like going to the, let's say you go and watch like four films or five movies a day. Of course, I would say, you know,
binge
don't
watching.
Do it, right?
Yeah.
Why? So there's certain things that don't have the same, harm as, for example, taking marijuana or consuming marijuana. Like going and watching a movie. Of course, if it's a movie that promotes values that are harmful, that's another discussion. Let's say a movie that is halal for you, it's some sort of a entertainment or fulfillment in your life.
Right.
That's not an issue because it doesn't cause the same harm. You're getting the same, you're achieving the same, right? But you don't get the harm with it. And that's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran, he acknowledges when it comes to alcohol and wine and stuff, maybe there's certain things that are positive. But he says the damage and the harm is even worse, right?
Mm. Right.
So it's not a discussion about whether there's some positive effects about it. Yeah, marijuana, there's definitely a positive effect. Like people, they get calm, they get a sense of calmness, right? But there's also negative sides to it. And the damage and the harm that you causes the individual and the society is greater than the actual benefit that you get from these things.
Brother Musa, if you want to accumulate all these cases and list the numbers of the issues that we might have around us, I think we have, a lengthy list. But when we have the ruling with us, I mean, the principle with us, as the respected Sheikh said, so we can ourselves induce what is good and what is bad for us, and what is harming and what is naturally prohibited, and we have to refrain from doing that. You mentioned, for example, marijuana. You mentioned, for example, films, videos, and everything. Whatever actually exceeds from this ordinary rate and actually makes us out of this wisdom is quite a clear principle that all of these that actually prevent us from being a wise person, they are known to be harmful and they have to be prevented and refrained from.
And that returns to the Mukallaf himself. That he feels that movies are distracting him too much from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Dear friends, one final question. Should we use drugs as a manner of treatment then?
Drugs as a manner of treatment. If there's no other solution, then maybe sometimes it gets necessary, yeah?
Actually, some of the drugs like opium were some medicine sometime.
Or morphine, for example.
When a person have to go undergo surgery, for example.
Yeah,
right? That's
so
different.
They have been using for such purposes. But since people actually misused them in the wrong, and they have used them in the wrong way, so they are now known as, for example, something which is going to be known as drugs. No, they have been medicine. I mean, sometime in the past, they have been a medicine.
Yeah. Right, and with that, we will unfortunately have to end today's discussion because we are out of time. Dear Sheikh, I thank you for
your
insightful knowledge.
Jazakallah khairan.
And I also thank the dear doctor for contributing to this discussion.
It was a great pleasure.
And I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Fi amanillah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The organization called First Amendment Praetorian is not as well known as the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys, but it worked closely with pro-Trump forces in the months after the 2020 presidential election. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Another Far-Right Group is Scrutinized in Effort to Aid Trump. Stay with us for more. Days after a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol on 6th of January last year, federal law enforcement officials pursued two high-profile extremist groups, the far-right nationalist Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers militia. Members of both organizations were quickly arrested on attention-grabbing charges, accused of plotting to interfere with the certification of the 2020 vote count. Now, congressional investigators are examining the role of another right-wing paramilitary group that was involved in a less publicly visible yet still expansive effort to keep President Donald Trump in power, the First Amendment Praetorian. Known in shorthand as 1AP, the group spent much of the post-election period working in the shadows with pro-Trump lawyers, activists, business executives, and military veterans to undermine public confidence in the election and to bolster Donald Trump's hopes of remaining in the White House. By their own account, members of the First Amendment Praetorian helped to funnel data to purported election fraud to lawyers suing to overturn the vote count. They guarded celebrities like Michael Flynn, Donald Trump's former national security advisor, at Stop the Steal rallies, where huge crowds gathered to demand that Donald Trump remain in office. And they supported an explosive proposal to persuade the president to declare a state of emergency and seize the country's voting machines in a bid to stay in power. None of First Amendment Praetorian's top operatives have been arrested in connection with the Capitol riot, and it remains unclear how much influence they exerted or how seriously criminal investigators are focused on them. Still, the group had men on the ground outside the building on 6th of January, and others at the Willard Hotel, near some of Donald Trump's chief allies. And in the days leading up to the assault, First Amendment Praetorian's Twitter account posted messages suggesting that the group knew violence was imminent. There may be some young National Guard captains facing some very, very tough choices in the next 48 hours, read one message posted by the group on 4th of January. Last month, citing some of these concerns, the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack issued a subpoena to Robert Patrick Lewis, the leader of the First Amendment Praetorian. On the same day, it sent similar requests to Enrique Tarrio, the chairman of the Proud Boys, and Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the Oath Keepers. As part of their inquiry, congressional investigators have obtained numerous audio recordings of First Amendment Praetorian members and are trying to determine how they fit into the broader investigation. Mr. Lewis did not respond to multiple requests for comments, but in recent months he has told parts of his story in online videos and podcasts. made up largely of Special Forces veterans and former intelligence officials, First Amendment Praetorian was founded in September of 2020 to protect Trump supporters from harassment at rallies and to safeguard free speech rights from tyrannical Marxist subversive groups. Robert Patrick Lewis wrote in a thread of tweets announcing the creation of the group. In a video attached to the thread, he said it would be a tactical mistake to discuss how many members First Amendment Praetorian had, noting that it was several times more than a dozen in a standard Special Forces operational unit. By the time he founded First Amendment Praetorian, Robert Patrick Lewis, who once served as a medic for a Special Forces team, had been out of the U.S. Army for a decade and reinvented himself as an author and commentator with an interest in military issues and right-wing politics. Among his works were two action novels describing how the Green Berets saved the American homeland from a fictional invasion, and a memoir depicting his rise from poverty and adoption to success in the 10th Special Forces Group, an elite unit stationed in Germany. First Amendment Praetorian's first mission, protecting conservative VIPs, came in October of 2020, when the group provided security at a march in Washington, led by the Walk Away Foundation, an organization that seeks to persuade Democratic voters to leave the party. Mr. Lewis said in a YouTube video posted that December. The foundation's leader, Brandon Straker, a former hairstylist in New York, was among those arrested in the Capitol attack. Court papers suggest that he recently began to cooperate with the government. At that event and others, First Amendment Praetorian provided more than bodyguards, Robert Patrick Lewis said. Its protective detail also included low-vis operators dressed in plain clothes, moving in the crowd. We had eyes and ears everywhere, he added. As the presidential election drew closer, Robert Patrick Lewis branched out beyond personal protection and started giving interviews, casting himself as a security expert to right-wing news outlets, including those connected to the QAnon conspiracy theory. Among his claims, which are so far unsubstantiated, was that professional analysts working for First Amendment Praetorian had infiltrated encrypted forums visited by members of the loose left-wing collective known as Antifa and had discovered plans for a nationwide attack. Our intelligence shows that no matter who wins the election, they're planning a massive Antifa Tet Offensive bent on destroying the global order, he told Fox News Channel just 2 days before the November 2020 election. Once the votes were cast, Mr. Lewis turned his attention back towards guarding pro-Trump luminaries at rallies in Washington, where throngs of people showed up in support of the lie that the election had been rigged. One of his clients was Ali Alexander, a prominent Stop the Steal organizer who was a featured speaker at the so-called Million MAGA March on 14th of November 2020. Mr. Alexander has since given testimony to the House Select Committee. Around the same time, First Amendment Praetorian became involved in another project connected to challenging the election. Members of the group, as Robert Patrick Lewis put it in his video in December, began to scour the internet for OSINT, or open source intelligence, about allegations of election fraud. Whatever evidence they found, he said, they sent to Sidney Powell, a Dallas-based lawyer who filed 4 federal lawsuits in late 2020 contesting the results of the presidential vote. The lawsuits, which ultimately failed and resulted in a federal judge imposing sanctions on Sidney Powell, describe without any credible evidence a plot by a cabal of international powers to hack U.S. voting machines and flip the count away from Donald Trump. By mid-December 2020, First Amendment Praetorian took a job protecting one of Sidney Powell's former clients, Michael Flynn, at a second large pro-Trump rally in Washington. The rally was put together public permits say, by Cindy Chafian, an organizer for the pro-Trump group Women of America First, which arranged for caravans of the president's supporters to rally across the country after the election. Cindy Chafian has also been subpoenaed by the House Select Committee. This rally on 12th of December 2020 helped to solidify First Amendment Praetorian's relationship with Michael Flynn and Cindy Chafian. It also brought the group into contact with the Oath Keepers, who joined their protective detail, according to a television interview that the militia's leader, Stuart Rhodes, gave that day. In the interview, Stuart Rhodes described how the two groups worked together at the rally. He then urged Donald Trump to wage war against traitors at home by imposing martial law. That was the same message that Sidney Powell, Michael Flynn, and others in their orbit were advising at the time. Robert Patrick Lewis says he played his own small part in the effort to persuade Donald Trump to declare martial law. On 18th of December, he said on a podcast last year, he drove Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn to the White House to meet with Donald Trump. It is not clear whether Mr. Lewis himself attended that meeting, where Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn urged the president to declare a national emergency and demand a recount of key swing states on live television, according to the business executive Patrick Byrne, who was also there. It was not long after the White House meeting that Robert Patrick Lewis, like others, turned his attention towards 6th of January, which was widely seen as the final opportunity for Donald Trump and his allies to stop the certification of Joe Biden's presidential win. On 5th of January, Mr. Lewis gave a speech at the event organized by Cindy Chafian at Freedom Plaza in Washington, telling the crowd that they should not be intimidated by the enemy at the gates. Another organizer of the events that day, Dustin Stockton, said that he saw Mr. Lewis and Cindy Chafian with other members of First Amendment Praetorian in a room at the Willard Hotel, not far from the war room where some of Donald Trump's top allies had gathered. On that day of the Capitol attack, at least one of Mr. Lewis's lieutenants, Jeffrey Flohr, a former Michigan police officer, was outside the building walking the grounds and talking on his cell phone just before the riot erupted, according to public videos. Cindy Chafian and her husband Scott Chafian were also in the mob outside of the Capitol building. Another member of the First Amendment Praetorian posted on Twitter that afternoon claiming he was in the overwatch position in Arlington County, Virginia, where prosecutors say the Oath Keepers had placed at a hotel an armed quick reaction force that was prepared to move quickly into Washington if needed. As for Robert Patrick Lewis, he told the Daily Beast last year that he was at the Willard Hotel again on 6th of January, away from the chaos at the Capitol. "Today is the day the true battles begin," he wrote on Twitter, just as the Capitol was breached.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.